Welcome to
BirdWorld.com. A podcast for those involved in designing, developing, and running websites. This is what everybody waits for. Hello and welcome to the 36th episode of BirdWorld.com, the podcast for those involved in designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis. My name's Paul Berg.
And my name's Marcus Lillington.
Hello, Marcus.
Hello, Paul. Nice Monday, to see you.
Monday morning again. Oh, no, it's not Monday. It's Tuesday morning again. Oh, those pesky bank holidays. Confusing life.
Oh, they're great.
Did you have a good one?
I like three-day weekends.
Yeah.
They're great. Although I tend to kind of try and ram a whole two-week holiday into them. That's the problem.
There was an interesting article on Alistair Part not long ago about reducing the number of days you work down to four.
Read it. Yep.
Very good. I like that idea.
Who's going to disagree with that?
No, I know.
Chris might, I suppose.
Yeah,
Chris is our colleague.
And is a workaholic.
Yeah.
So there you go.
They reckon you can get more. You can get the same amount of work into four standard days that you can into five and a half or whatever most people work.
Yes. So, yeah, might be worth considering.
Yeah.
Headscope goes 4 days a week. Anyway,
nods from behind you there, Paul.
Yes.
So we're in the office today, which is a bit of a barren office. We've just got one other headscaper, which is Pete. Hi, Pete.
Hello.
Out of the four employees that are supposed to be in this office today, there's one.
Yeah.
How sad is that? Before I forget, I have to do something.
So I might nod off from time to time. My comment about fitting 2 weeks. Two-week holiday into a three-day one.
Yes. So there's something I need to do before we get going. Somebody complained that American listeners don't know how to find our website because they don't know how to spell Boag World. So I have to spell it out very slowly and
very
clearly.
Well, no one knows how to spell Boag, do they? World, I would accept that most people do.
I think it's my pronunciation.
Speak,
yeah. It's about something else. So, if you want to know about this podcast, go to www.boagworld.com/podcast. I presume you can spell podcast. There we go. I've done it now. I'm happy. Why are you looking at me like that?
Could it be any more patronising, I'm wondering?
Yeah. Possibly. I could have gone B for ball.
Yes, you could have done. Yes.
So, anyway, let's move on to some news. So, the world of accessibility has gone to shit, basically. Oh, what a horrible mess. If you haven't read already, Alistair Part's going to get another plug now. A guy called Joe Clark has posted an interesting article on Alistair Part.
It's a very long article, but it's very powerful.
Yes. Now, Joe Clark, just in case you don't know who Joe Clark is, Joe Clark is an expert in accessibility and is very well known and very well thought of within the accessibility community, but he's also very opinionated and very vocal in what he believes, which is great and something that I can fully associate with. So
really?
Yeah, I got a lot of time for Joe Clark. He's a good guy. So, and then one of the things that he's been doing is he's been working with the Web Accessibility Initiative on the new set of Web Accessibility Guidelines. We had version one that was done, 7 years ago, something like that.
And we went through in very fine detail not so long ago.
Yes, we did. That's very true.
And our favourite client said that he got bored listening to it.
Did he?
Sorry, that was just a plug for Matt. Okay.
Because he was upset.
Upset that we said somebody else was our favourite client.
Honestly. So fickle, aren't they? So fickle.
I know.
Yeah, so now the version 2 is about to come out. And Joe Clark, in this article on Alistair Part, just completely slams it and discredits it entirely and slags off the members of the WAI, the Web Accessibility Initiative, and just I, it couldn't have been worded a lot stronger, could it, really?
No, I mean, I found it very interesting indeed. I mean, I was about to make lots of comments, but obviously there's a lot more has been written on it that I haven't read since, so I'm just going to sit here and listen to what I'm going to comment.
No, make your comments, that's fine, that's okay.
It seemed... Well, you know, I've seen Joe Clark speak, and I've made my mind up about him, and yes, he is a vocal, opinionated person, but he's also very intelligent and seems to be quite a fair person.
Yeah.
So I'm not thinking there's any kind of political point scoring going on from him.
I wouldn't have thought so.
I don't think so.
I don't think that he's that manipulative a person.
So I kind of thought, well, you've got a point here. Quite a lot of points, actually.
And it just makes logical sense. I mean, basically what he's saying is that, amongst many other things, that they've tried to go so broad, and they're thinking ahead, and they've so that they've made it completely technology neutral, so it doesn't actually talk about, you know, web pages or things like that. You know,
there's some fantastic use of
the terminology.
Of
is just unbelievable.
Yeah,
and it's all got very, very woolly. And also, the other thing that it's suffering from is the fact that the people that sit on this committee are kind of industry leaders within, that produce, I don't know, accessibility software or that, you know, a big movers and shakers.
It matters to them what's written down, basically.
Yeah, and they're
we have to be careful now. Can we just say what we like?
Oh, I'm just saying what you like. And they're kind of being, what's the word? They're feathering their own nest to some degree. And one of the big things that came out was the fact that they're saying that the guidelines have been made in such a way that they're kind of leaning towards automated testing. Mm. It's just not possible with accessibility. It's a subjective thing.
Well, what needed to happen with WCAG 2 over WCAG 1 was it to be clearer.
Yeah.
And simpler, probably.
Yeah.
Simpler, clearer, one or maybe two lists of, important and really important, and this is how you apply it. It's really obvious what it means.
Yeah.
None of that applies.
No.
To this.
But after saying all that, neither you nor me have sat down and read the version 2
Correct.
Of these guidelines.
No,
so
I'm purely
reliant on what Joe Clark has said.
I'm going entirely on what he's pulled out of it.
I've
seen enough to be convinced, if you like.
Yeah, but I was quite surprised that the Web Standards Project, which the Web Standards Project, they're the people that kind of stick up for, the web developer community in encouraging people to conform to standards and stuff. They seem to be defending the WCAG 2.
How so, though? Not just we're behind it. Is there any reasoning there?
There was. It wasn't hugely detailed what was said, but, you know, it was saying, it was basically just contradicting and saying, you know, it's a step in the right direction, you know, they're moving forward and...
Well, I don't think it is from what I've read.
Well, no, I don't think I agree
think it's
either.
Quite the opposite.
Yeah. So, anyway, it's left me a little depressed about the whole state of accessibility.
Well, as I said to you after reading it, the concern is if any countries take it as law.
Oh, yeah.
Then it does really become tricky because, according to Joe Clark, you can't build... You can't actually meet these guidelines. Some of them, it's impossible.
Yeah.
In which case, you know, then that means that we're putting our clients in positions where they can be sued because we can't meet these particular new guidelines. I mean, okay, that may be a bit extreme, but in theory, it's a possibility.
It's also going to be... It's going to be difficult for web developers because, for example, we're going to look at these guidelines and we're going to go, okay, look, this is silly. You know, we need to take a more pragmatic approach to accessibility here. You know, we need to kind of come up with a sensible, accessible solution. But we're going to have the battle of trying to convince clients that they, you know, it's not enough just to check the WCAG 2 checkbox and say, yes, I've conformed to that. You know, that they're going to have to actually start thinking independently. Of course, on the flip side, that's a good thing because hopefully these guidelines might be so discredited that people do actually start thinking about accessibility and how to make their site accessible in preference to just blindly going, let's conform to this set of guidelines.
Yeah.
The only thing that I did wonder about Joe Clark's motivation is that he's now broken away entirely from the W3C and is setting up his own little group that are going to amend the original guidelines.
I got the impression that was based on his. I don't know whether he'd done that kind of like before. He'd made his realization about what the WCAG 2 guidelines were going to be, or whether he'd read them.
I think it's supposed to be a response to it.
Yeah, well, that's kind of fair enough, then, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, I guess, if that's really the case. Mm. And I'm just trying to remain balanced in it because, you know, at the moment, I want to kind of stand behind Joe Clark and say, yeah, go on, mate, go for it. Come up with something sensible.
My concern is that maybe we're being slightly. Luddite-ish is probably not the right word, but you know what I mean? It's like, well, we know our WCAG 1 guidelines, we're experts in it, and you know, actually, maybe 5 years down the line, we'll be looking back at what we're saying now and thinking, that was a bit strong, and actually, no, we didn't really mean it.
Yeah.
But who knows? I mean, that's hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on, because otherwise, we're going to stay on this forever. Just another bit of housekeeping news that I wanted to do is one of the kind of most common emails that I get from people is what books can you recommend to get me started in XXX, whether that's, although I wrote that on the post that I put on our website, you know. The most common question I get asked is, you know, what books can you recommend to get me started in XXX? And somebody pointed out that I'm recommending porn books. But anyway. But, you know, whether it's get me started in web design, get me started with web standards, you know, get me started with CSS or whatever. So after much consideration and getting fed up with answering these same questions again and again and again, I've now put together a comprehensive list of books that I would recommend, and I've put that on the Berwick World site. So if you check out berwickworld.com/podcast, see spelling earlier, then you can select this episode and there'll be a link to the list of book recommendations I've got. And even a convenient link over to Amazon, because I'm nice like that. Although that's not going to help you much if you're outside of the UK, because you'll go to amazon.co.uk.
I thought I was bad this morning, but you're even worse.
I am even worse.
Shall we move on to Rob's question?
I think we should do.
Okay, this is Rob's question. I was slightly confused at one point in last week's show. You and Andy Budd, this is, seemed to slightly disagree about the place of user testing in the design process. He seemed to imply that you can't user test design, while you said that that was what you did. What gives?
We disagreed. I think. It didn't seem the right kind of time. You know, as an interviewer, you're not supposed to start, you know, punching the person that.
You're wrong.
We didn't disagree that. I think we came at things from a slightly different point of view, and perhaps Andy was seeing it from a slightly different perspective than I was. I believe that user testing against design can be a helpful thing to do in order to refine the design process and to diffuse arguments over personal opinions, because there are often times when a client has a particular aversion to something in a design that you might produce as a designer. Mm. And there's always a difficult conflict there, because you know, on one hand, you know, you as the designer or the trained individual, you're the person that has, you know, spent years learning how to do design work. But on the other hand, the client's the one paying the bills, and they're the ones, you know, that ultimately the site is being delivered to. So sometimes I use user testing as a method to resolve those differences and arguments, to in effect to prove to client that I'm correct in what I'm saying and the approach that I'm taking. Sometimes I turn out not to be correct, but yes. Obviously that's very, very rare. So it's good from that point of view. It's also good when you work, which we do a lot, with larger organisations where there are multiple people involved in the decision-making process. So you get a lot of individuals within an organisation that would disagree, you know, that potentially have different opinions about design, and they can have disagreements internally. And so again, user testing can help to kind of diffuse that kind of argument. Now, Andy's argument is very much that the designer should decide this, and I totally agree with him. Yes, he should. And Andy, their approach needs to be more, I will fight that corner, you know, and I will, you know, but my approach is more, well, let's put some users in front of it and see what happens. I think it is really important to say that user testing of design is very different to usability testing. And I think a little bit that's where the misunderstanding came between the two of us, that actually he was thinking, well, how could you do usability testing on design? And I mean, I'm putting words into Andy's mouth, which isn't fair, but that's kind of my interpretation of it. So just to briefly explain what I consider to be design usability testing. What is it not? It is not usability testing. It's a different thing. It's also not about personal preference discussions. So do you like this colour? What do you think of this typeface? You know, is that do you think that layout's pretty?
That is what's up to the designer.
Yes. Oh, very much so. Mm. And this is again what I think the lines that Andy was thinking that I was suggesting, and he was perfectly correct when he said it's too small a group, to test that kind of thing. If you're testing thousands of people, then maybe statistically you can take a response to it. But with small groups, which is all you'd ever test, you're going to just get personal opinion coming to the front again. Mm. It's like design by committee, which we all know comes out as the lowest common denominator. So that's what it's not. What design user testing is about, it's about engaging an emotional response to a design within a specific demographic group. So whereas I would argue that with usability testing, probably your audience isn't as important, you don't have to have the perfect demographic in order to pick up the majority of usability problems, I would suggest when it comes to the design, you do have to have the right group of people. If you're testing, if you're designing for teenagers, you need to test against teenagers and that kind of stuff. So just to give you an idea of how I would perhaps run a design user test session. So we'd get the right demographic first. There's several little exercises we do. Two of the main ones that I'll quickly mention. One is what I call the flash test. we flash at them, though. What we do is we'll show them a design very briefly for just a couple of seconds, and then take it away again. And we will ask them to comment on what they've just seen. And we'll ask them, basically, in particular, what did they see? What did they take in? And in what order they took those in. So I guess this borders on usability testing, but it does kind of help to get an idea of whether the emphasis is right. Mm. Not just the position of elements, but the size of elements, the colour of elements, all of those kinds of things. So it is a kind of usability testing, but it's more design orientated.
Exactly, because a designer may have been given some guidelines by the client about use of logo, strap lines, that kind of thing, that you have to fit within a particular, proportions or whatever. They might be wrong.
Yeah.
And going through this kind of exercise will highlight that.
Exactly.
So it is a useful thing to do.
But probably the most important part of user testing, and the second thing I wanted to touch on, is that we will show the users multiple versions of the same design. Okay, with different elements change, whether that be layout, whether that be typography, whether it be colour, imagery. So there'll be different combinations of the designs, and we will show them. What we won't ask, as I've already said, is what do you think of this design? Is it nice? What do you like about it?
What's your favourite?
Yeah. We won't do that. What we will ask them is to assign words to each design that they've seen, but not like words that say nice. It's shit or nice. We'll ask them to come up with descriptive words like dynamic, friendly, conservative, all of those kinds of words, so that you can see whether it's generating the right emotional response in them or not. So that is the key to the method that we use, is showing them multiple designs, getting them to give descriptions to those multiple designs. And also really basic stuff like, do they get it? Do they know what the site's about? Stuff like that. But again, that borders on usability testing. So, yes, that was what I was getting at when I was talking about that in the interview. Cool. Okay, so let's move on to today's Technobuster. Bugwrite.com. Okay, so first of all, thank you so much to all of you that wrote in with additional Technobuster ideas after I said that I was running out in the previous episode.
We've got weeks and weeks now then.
Well, we've got a few more. Cool. And we've also had some nice suggestions for alternative things we can do from time to time.
Yes.
Instead, so that's good.
Definitely.
And the second thing I want to say before we get onto this Technobuster is, here is your official warning. This Technobuster may contain errors. I was really hoping...
I actually read some of this and thought, is he sure about that?
Oh, no, you haven't, have you? Oh, I'm going to crash and burn. I was really hoping Mark would be in the office so I could get him in for this bit. But he's not here.
Get him on MSN first, yeah. Typing while you're speaking.
Help! I'm so scared I'm going to get this wrong. But it's a really good suggestion for a subject, and so I really feel that we probably ought to cover it. It's a suggestion from Derek. Thank you very much for this, Derek. You're going to now see me humiliate myself because of your question. So basically, he's saying that we ought to talk about the different server-side languages that are out there. Just to give clients a bit of an indication of how these, you know, what all these acronyms are that they might have thrown at them.
Yes.
We talked about the difference between server-side and client-side before. But just to remind you, server-side language is basically something that will sit on the web server and will do lots of clever programmy stuff. I'm keeping this as light as possible.
Yeah, it's working for me, Paul.
Yeah, yawning there. You really don't make this easy. You basically have some programmatic logic on the server that will then serve up HTML pages that the web browser will use, or HTML content. So, but there are lots of different types of these programmatic languages, and they all do very similar types of things. But they're different brands, I guess, is one way of putting it, from different suppliers. So they're in competition with one another, basically. So you might hear chucked around words like ASP, .NET, Cold Fusion, Domino, PHP, WebSphere. The list really does go on, although I think those are probably the most major ones. And so now I'm going to get emails saying, oh yes, what about blobby blob blob language, you know, or whatever. But yeah, I would have thought those are the biggest names that spring to mind.
What's JSP?
Oh, JSP's another good one.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's another one. Yeah, very good.
So I don't think any more.
Yeah, just up to annoy me now.
Yeah.
So there's basically a list of these. And as I said, they all come from different people and they're all in competition with one another. Each of those languages have different strengths and different weaknesses. But to some degree, it's personal taste as well.
It's what you know.
Yeah. So a programmer or a developer may know, you know, two or three of these and has a particular preference towards one.
Don't see Cold Fusion as much as we used to.
Well, I think that's just because we don't work in Cold Fusion while we used to.
I hate to say it, but I do notice things like that on websites I look at, and I tend not to see the CFM tag.
But then don't forget, there's a lot more masking of the technologies behind which are being used behind the scenes. So, for example, you go to the Headscape site, you know, from the URLs alone, you would have no idea what technology has been used behind the scene. So
Is that true?
I'm
looking at the BBC site. What's .stm? That's one I don't know.
I have to say I don't know that one either. Will you stop asking me questions? No doubt someone will know. Someone will know.
I'm enjoying myself now.
Post it. If you know the answer to Marcus's stupid questions, please post them on the comments associated with show notes. Okay, so to some degree it's personal taste. It has to be said, mind, that a good developer will be able to move fairly seamlessly from one language to another. They're all much in a muchness in some ways about how they approach things. I'm probably going to get criticism for that, but I know that's a safe thing to say because Mark has told me that before.
Right.
Because he says he can pick up any language, but then he's almost as arrogant as me. he's going to pay for not being here. I'm going to be talking about him. Okay, so... But from a client's perspective, somebody that's running a website, really, this isn't your problem. You don't need to worry too much about which language somebody goes with. It's down to the developer to pick the right language for your site. However, there is a but attached to that, which is that you need to ensure that your hosting environment can support whatever language your developer's using. Now, in most cases, the developer will sort that out as well. They'll be sorting out your hosting environment, or at least be in direct contact with whoever's running your hosting environment. But there are occasions where, for one reason or another, we've come across clients before that have said, oh, it has to be on this hosting environment. And that environment hasn't actually been able to support any server-side language at all, which kind of, you know, screws you a bit.
There is another but as well.
Oh, okay.
Some clients insist upon open source.
That's true.
Use of technology, i.e. PHP. I'm not sure about ColdFusion.
ColdFusion's not open source, no.
It's sort of semi, though, isn't it? I'm sure there's a kind of...
See, why do you bring up things
that I know nothing about?
Nothing
anyway,
about.
But certainly ASP is Microsoft language, and
ColdFusion is Adobe, isn't it?
Of course it is. Yes.
Or what, Macromedia that is now Adobe.
Macrodobia. Yes, and WebSphere is IBM.
Yes.
But PHP is not, and I'm sure there are other open source languages. I'm just to say, we have had specifications of
sure.
Everything has to be open source.
Sure. Yes, so sometimes clients do it, yeah, add that into it. And so obviously your web server needs to be able to support that. So basically the box that your website sits at needs to be able to run whichever language you're currently looking at. Now, it has to be said that a lot of these boxes, these web servers, are actually capable of running, or a lot of hosting environments are capable of running multiple versions. So for example... I use a hosting environment that does PHP and does ASP.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the Technobuster. Bugworld.com. Okay, so our main feature today is on developing your site structure. So in other words, we're going to look at the subject of information architecture, which is an information architecture, just to be clear, is the process of organizing the information, the content on your site, into a hierarchical structure. Is that clearer? I think that sounds more confusing.
I've got some really good words on this. I'm just carry on talking. I'll find some good stuff.
You've got some good words on information architecture.
I have, yes.
I hate it when you say continue talking, because I feel like...
Keep talking, Paul.
Okay.
So, make them laugh.
feeling the pressure. So basically, it's about organising your site into that tree structure, and knowing how to group content together in the correct sections and stuff like that. So we're going to talk a little bit about the process of creating an information architecture and how to go about organising that content together. And then we're going to look at the mistakes that are often made when you're first doing information architecture. Now, the reason that we've decided to include this is because it's a bit of a grey area in some respects, you know.
Well, as to whose responsibility
it is. Yeah. Is this something the client does? Is it something the web design company does? You know, is it a collaboration between the both? And I think in my ideal world, it's something that the designer and the client do together. But the reality of it, sometimes the client ends up having to do it. Sometimes the web designer has to do it for whatever reason. And it's difficult because it combines multiple skill sets.
Mm.
On one hand, there's a requirement to know and understand the business and the organisation and the content, which obviously the client knows more about. And on the other hand, it requires skills from a web designer about how users interact with websites and respond to websites.
Yeah, I mean, it also particularly when it comes to... I mean, content structure's one thing, but terminology is something that it's you kind of need to see it from... The opposite of the client, it's the client's users that need to think about.
Yeah,
maybe not 100%, because I don't think you can take that too far.
Oh yeah.
But terminology, I think, needs a third party of some description to go in and just question: are you sure you want to be calling that? You know,
because if you're internally within an organisation, perhaps this is getting onto pitfalls a little bit. Mm. You're so used to the acronyms and the shorthands used to describe stuff that you kind of just presume the rest of the world knows them, which
exactly.
Obviously isn't always the case. So have you found the little bit of writing that you were going to look
up? It's a lot of writing, but I might pull the odd thing out. It's one of our proposals. It's huge.
we have such ridiculously large proposals. I reckon our proposals could be a third of the length.
What I need to do is see your notes so I don't just start contradicting you all over the place.
Are you implying that we don't have a consistent message on this subject?
No, not at all. It's close to my heart at the moment, because I'm actually doing some work on
Well, that's why I thought I'd do this subject, because then I can actually explain to you in single syllables how to do it.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. I hope Tony's not listening to this.
Right, so let's talk a little bit about the process of how you create an information architecture, Marcus.
I do know.
At the end of the day, it's... I'm so rude to you. At the end of the day, it's actually not a very high-tech process. There are loads of bits of software out there that kind of help in this, but...
There's good bits of software for drawing it, for kind of getting it down on paper, or on screen, as it were, but the actual thinking it through and getting in the right place is... manual,
yeah.
I think.
Well, no. I mean, some people do it straight into a PC. What I was about to say is that I actually prefer bits of paper.
Yeah, so do I.
It's really what I do is so you write down all the content areas of the website because you know roughly what the content is going to be and what you're going to cover. Then I print all those out. I then cut them into lots of strips of paper and just scatter them over the floor. I mean, the one I remember doing most was the National Trust one, which is this enormous sprawling site. And I just took over the whole office floor. You know, I was covering this huge area with hundreds of bits of paper. And then you just start grouping those bits of paper together in a logical order and just kind of, simple as that.
Well, that is card sorting. That's you. Well, it sort of is. No, what you just described is a method of testing your content.
Are you talking about user card sorting?
Yes.
Yes. I think there's a slight difference. Okay. So Marcus, as normal, has skipped on to the next point.
I was getting bored, Paul. Yeah. What do you expect?
Just moving on.
No, but it's still bits of paper,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But there is a difference between... Right, for example, in that National Trust example I just gave a minute ago, I had several hundred bits of paper on the floor that I was sorting into different piles.
You tend not to do it on the floor with users.
Yeah, I know. But also, you don't tend to give them several hundred bits of paper, do you?
Yeah.
You do?
Oh, yeah.
No, that's so bad.
All right, maybe not hundreds. A hundred, probably.
No, last time we did card sorting, I distinctly remember narrowing it down to about 30 cards.
That would be on an argument on podcast? No. Pete will back me up because he was there. Hi, well, Pete. Pete's in the office still.
Hello.
Yes.
Then I think that is bad practice, personally. It's not often we have an argument in the podcast, but I think my opinion is if you present a user with 100 cards, you're just going to totally swamp them and overwhelm them.
It was an intranet, which I think meant that there, everyone looking at the cards was very, very familiar with everything on them. It meant that we weren't... If you were testing for a website with different demographic of people that were using a public-facing website, then yes, you could confuse people a lot more easily than an intranet audience who know all of this content inside out. So I'm right and you're wrong. I'd love to know actually how many there were, but I could look it up probably, but there were certainly more than 30 or 40.
Ooh. I don't know. I think, I do see what you mean about the intranet, but... okay, there's a difference between theory and practice. And okay, we might have not done it very well in the past, but my suggestion is that it should be no more than 30 cards when you're actually doing card sorting. So card sorting basically is...
Yeah, we have to tell people what it actually is.
Yeah.
What we're arguing about.
We kind of have, because you said card sorting is the same as what I've done on the floor.
Yeah.
But what you tend to do with card sorting is you get in a group of people that you meet with individually, one after another, sit down in a room, present them with 30 cards.
A deck of cards.
A small deck of cards.
Yes.
And you get them to organise them into parts. So instead of you sitting on the floor doing it, then you get your users to do it. What I'm recommending is you reduce that number of cards and don't have every conceivable page on the website when you do it with users.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be
too
much.
Didn't anyway, because I mean, there was hundreds and hundreds in this particular case. But yeah, I mean, and one of the most useful exercises that we did with them was get them to give names to their little pile, the groups that they'd completed.
Good point, yeah.
Because then you get a really a sort of view from users of what sections should be called.
Yeah.
And they tend to name them sensibly rather than sort of using some jargon and the like.
Yeah, because I think almost one of the most common mistakes with people that are putting together information architecture is they kind of know that everything has to be grouped together logically, but they don't give the attention to the naming of those sections that's a really important factor in it.
Hmm.
Yes, so let's look at a few of the pitfalls of information architecture, as we seem to have wandered onto that subject anyway.
Yes.
One thing is to kind of a little bit contradict. Well, no, you actually said it yourself. Although information architecture is about user, creating a structure to your site that's focused around your users, it is not entirely about them, which is what you said yourself.
It's about your brand as well.
Yeah, there are a lot of other aspects that should impact and will impact information architecture. Your brand is one, and how you want to present that brand. The nature of the content itself can to some degree dictate the structure and the naming of sections. You know, if you're talking about a product name, for example, the users that arrive at your site might not know that product name, but you should still name the section after the product name. Mm. One, from a branding point of view, one, because that's what the product's called. Yes, you know, exactly. That's the content's dictating it.
Yeah, and having a section called Find Our Product Here would be
silly.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
And very
patronizing
long.
And
you
very
would also
long.
Really annoy yeah. any designer yeah. that's trying to fit yeah. that into a navigation bar.
Yes, or find. That would be a perfect example.
And that's another example about how information architecture isn't always user-centric, is you do have to keep those section names flipping short, in order to work for a designer, that a designer's got to fit those in. Now, you can say there's also a usability benefit of that because it helps you to scan through the list, but there are some times where actually a longer title would be more descriptive, but it's going to ruin the design and you have to compromise. So one of your first pitfall is that it's not always about the user, despite what you may think. Another mistake that can often be made with information architecture is creating too many paths to the same information. So I've often seen, people as they've worked on information architecture go, okay, well, I've got this page, and I don't know whether it should sit under section A or section B, so I'm going to put it under both. And in fact, I'm also going to link to it from section C, D, and E as well.
Yes, and four links from the homepage.
Yeah. So it can get very overwhelming as there's too many different paths, especially when you add on top of all of that the kind of alternate methods of navigation that you're going to have through breadcrumbs, through search, through related links, it kind of just goes on and on and on. And it can leave your website, instead of feeling like a neat, tree structure that people can mentally conceptualize, it feels more like spider web when the spider's been on acid. Have you ever seen that video?
Yeah.
That is just so great. Basically, it's a video where they took spiders and injected them with various drugs.
I know, yeah. And kind of cruel, really. But yes, it was very interesting.
It was fascinating.
From a scientific point of view only.
Yes. And this is now totally off topic.
Yes, it is.
So dragging it back.
Information architecture on acid, man.
Our new proposed technique.
Yeah.
Yes. Too much information is another big pitfall.
Which is where we were going there, really. Just too much information.
Too much information. Why, you know.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that, Paul?
Including every conceivable piece of content, whether or not it should be on the website. I think a part of creating an information architecture is to hold each piece of your card in your hand and go, should this even be on the site?
Yeah.
You know, there are some times when you think they should be requesting a brochure to get this.
Hmm.
Or they should be, or only three people in the world are ever going to want this particular piece of information. And the tendency is to go, if three people want it, we might as well put it on there.
Hmm.
But the other 6 million people, because obviously you've got a very popular site,
yes, indeed,
aren't going to look at that.
And it can confuse
and
the whole issue.
And it's going to cause confusion, there's more items in the navigation, etc., etc.
Yep. Yep.
So does that feel like a relevant point? Because normally when you say, what do you mean by that, you mean, I disagree with you, Paul.
No, I didn't, it could, you weren't being very user-friendly with your terminology.
These notes are written for my benefit, not for yours. Okay, the next one is not considering scalability and the evolution of your site. That often, and I've been guilty of this before myself, you create an information architecture around those bits of paper that you've got on your floor or wherever, and you don't actually consider new stuff that might come along. You know, what if they add another 20 products, or, you know, what if the business branch is in a different direction? You know, okay, you can't cover every eventuality, and, you know, the company is always going to do something that throws you, but you should at least, you know, give a thought to scalability and evolution and where your site goes in the future, and try and plan ahead and try and have sections that aren't so incredibly specific that anything new that comes along won't fit.
Yeah, where does that go? Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. The next thing is one that I've only kind of started adding in recently into my thinking, which is traditionally we always used to go, well, okay, we don't want the information architecture to get too deep, because if it gets really deep, that's a lot of clicks to get through to the information you want.
Yeah.
And although there are some valid reasons for saying don't have too many clicks to get to certain information, it's not as big an issue as it was. It used to be a big issue because of, you know, you'd have to wait 20 seconds after each click. But that's not so much of an issue now. We do need to begin to accept that broadband users are beginning to make up the vast majority of people that are accessing the web, depending on which country you're in, I have to say. Immediately after
yes.
that.
That's Paul scared himself.
I've made a statement.
Yes.
I'm therefore scared. So,
it's also about people are more used to using
the
websites,
web.
Full
yeah.
stop. So, yeah, I mean, and it's like being allowed to go bigger than 800, or being allowed to go bigger than 600 pixels deep.
Yes.
On the homepage.
Yeah, then people will realise they can scroll.
Yeah.
And actually, it's only about 450, 430 yeah, pixels deep in
exactly.
the toolbars.
But this is another example of it's a good thing to let people have more clicks. It's a good thing to be able to let them scroll down, because you can get, you know, it makes things more usable at the end of the day.
Yeah, because you can space everything out,
yeah.
and yeah, you're exactly. not cramming everything in and making it hard to read and take in, etc. And then my final warning about accessibility. Usability, accessibility, information architecture. What are we talking about today? They all blur one into another. My final thing about information architecture is don't get too hung up on things like this. You know, where people list off all of these do's and don'ts about information architecture. The truth is that every website is unique. And sometimes you do have to make the best judgment you can on some of these things. And sometimes you have to ignore some of the rules in order to get it to work for the content that you're working with.
So definitely.
Really, that about wraps the subject up?
Not for me.
Oh, why?
No.
You've added some more, have you?
I'm looking at some of the things that we do for various clients, and we've covered pretty much all of it. Apart from the fact that with certain organisations, especially big ones that are kind of large, sprawling in... organisations or companies, if you can get the client to pay for it, go in and interview people.
Stakeholder interviews.
Exactly.
Yeah.
People that have got an opinion, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like, card sorting is kind of scientific. It's like you give people cards and they sort them out and you give them names and then you put it on a spreadsheet and you look at trends, that kind of thing. This is literally going in and you certainly should get a we call them semi-structured interviews. So that what that means is we'll have a bunch of questions, but what we really want is for people to start talking and giving us their opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Very valuable, especially if you've got a lot of departments who are very strong within themselves and they consider themselves to be the most important, etc., etc. It's good to be able to kind of take all of those opinions into one document, if you like, and show it to the client.
Okay, so you're talking about interviewing people internally within the organisation.
Yes.
About their content areas.
Yes.
So it's on those websites where multiple people are managing different parts of the website.
Well, a university is a fantastic example of
that. Different departments of different schools and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Why do we say that's got benefits?
It's two benefits to it. One is it makes us aware of all the content, and obviously we're going to be getting all of the different departments are going to be talking up their content.
Yeah.
But through that process, we are, you know, we don't have any favourites, so we can kind of look at it rationally and say, well, okay, well, we see what they're saying.
Yeah.
But what? So from that, we can then take that to the central, usually marketing department, and say, these are our recommendations based upon what people have told us.
And I guess,
and it provides that marketing department with a rational reason for why, you know, Department X isn't on the homepage, for example.
Yeah.
And that's what it's all about.
And I guess it helps as well when you have those hundreds of bits of card over the floor that, you know, they're more than bits of paper with just a name written on them. You know, you've got a better understanding of what's going on.
The interviews are usually the first thing.
Cool.
Often we'll do a review of the existing site and existing content, and then the interviews come next, followed by card sorting.
Yeah. You said there were two things.
I covered it in the same sentence, I think.
I think all right then, in that case I think there's a third, which I think there's a political benefit.
Well, yeah, that's what it was.
Oh right.
Because we've given that department
a
rational
event.
Oh, I see what you mean. No, sorry, yeah. I'm just saying the political thing with us is often we're often brought in to do information architecture work because the central department, if you like, can't get agreement.
Yeah.
So by going us we have to
independent third party body.
Exactly, yeah. But yes, there is also a chance to vent, which is another thing as well.
Yeah, I mean, it gives the stakeholders a feeling that they're included in the process.
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, and should be.
Because we've listened to their opinions, etc., etc.
So, I'm happy to stop now.
Is that it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, right. So there we go. That's information architecture. A very brief overview. Obviously, I suspect in the future we'll get into more detail, but that keeps us going for now. Right, so let's wrap up, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you've got any comments on anything that you've heard in today's show and find any of it interesting in any way whatsoever and feel that you want to criticise Marcus, then please post your...
I'll pass them on to Paul.
Please post your comments on the notes section of the Barrack World site. So if you go to barrackworld.com, I'm not going to spell it again... /podcast, select episode, 36?
Yep.
Then you can go in, and at the bottom of the page, there's a form you can fill in to add your comments to what's been said. We'd really love to hear your feedback. It's always good to get comments on the show.
Definitely.
Or on the different things we raise. Or on suggestions of what you think we ought to do in the future as well. That's always good to have as well. If you get other ideas about what you want to see on the show, things that you want us to cover, send them to paul@barrackworld.com. Next week's show is going to be a bit of a design special, really. It's going to be a frenzy of design things. We're going to look at designing for your CMS and specific problems that you'll come across when you're designing CMS content management system.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to look a little bit at the design process and how we go about creating designs. And that's about it. This podcast has been brought to you by headscape.co.uk. I'm Paul Boag, and he's
Marcus Lillington.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.